This is America Weekend. I am Paul Harris. Thanks for listening. We're coming up on the one-year anniversary of an American tragedy, the bombings at the 2013 Boston Marathon that left three dead and 264 wounded. You may remember seeing the nonstop television coverage of what was going on in Boston and in Watertown that day. It was the first time we heard the phrase shelter in place, as the entire town of Boston was on lockdown, essentially, while the FBI and the Boston police and later the Watertown police were searching for whoever it was that did this. It was a story that gripped our imagination because it just seemed like an American classic day torn apart by violence. And we wondered why. Why would somebody do something like this? Who did whatever this was? And are they going to catch him? The whole story is recapped in a terrific new book by two reporters for the Boston Globe, Jenna Russell and Scott Hellman. The book is called Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery and the Epic Hunt for Justice. And Scott Hellman joins me now. Welcome to America Weekend.
Thanks for having me on.
One of the things about this story that gripped me when it was going on was the use by the police and the FBI in Boston of video surveillance and releasing those images to the public in an attempt to try to catch the bombers. Was there debate inside the law enforcement agencies about that?
There was a big debate, and there were two schools of thought. On one hand, you had the Boston Police Commissioner, Ed Davis, who was advocating releasing the photos. He was worried about public safety. He wanted to bring this to a conclusion. He wanted the public's help in identifying them. On the other side, you had the FBI. The FBI typically works cases, you know, very meticulously. They want to nail it all down. They want to go in. They want to get the guys themselves and have the case completely, wrapped up. Ultimately, the Boston police view, I think, won out, and in part they were forced by some speculation because, as you may remember, there was a lot of kind of online vigilantism going on where people were sharing photos on Facebook and on Reddit and all these other sites saying, oh, I think this is the guy, this is the guy. And I think the FBI really wanted to head that off and say, no, here are the two guys we want, only look for these two.
Yeah, I remember the New York Post put a front page cover picture of two guys on there who turned out not to be associated with this whatsoever, and that ended up in a lawsuit that, to my knowledge, may still be going on. So in retrospect, what do the police and the FBI say about that decision to release that information?
They still feel like it's the right decision. I mean, you know, on one hand, you could say, well, this is what led the brothers to go on their sort of final rampage, and maybe it cost the life of this MIT police officer, Sean Collier, who was tragically assassinated. At the same time, if they hadn't done that, there's a question of what else these brothers could have done. There was some indication they wanted to go to New York. They had more bombs on them, so were they going to go to Times Square and cause further destruction? You know, we'll never know that. But I think they feel like they made the right decision, and ultimately they brought this week to a conclusion.
What's happening on Boylston Street today in those buildings that were damaged by the blast?
It feels, in a way, just like it always did before the bombing. I mean, the stuff has been repaired. You can't really tell, where it happened exactly. At the same time, I think it will always be a sort of special, somber place, and it's really hard to walk past there kind of without thinking about it. You still see some people sort of pause and you can see them walk differently during that, down that part of the sidewalk. And I think it'll be really interesting to see when we have our next marathon here coming up on the 21st, how people feel, when they're standing on those special spots.
Will the finish line be on Boylston again?
It will. Everything will be the same. I mean, except for there will be a much heavier security presence, but they've really tried hard to make the 118th marathon just like all the other ones before last year. And so, finish line is the same place, the specialness of the marathon, all that stuff. They're really trying to preserve the magic of it.
You include stories in here of some of the survivors and some of the families of the people who did not survive the blasts. Would you share with my audience a little bit of the story of Crystal Campbell?
Sure. So Crystal Campbell is one of five people that we really follow in the book, and whose experience we hope tells a larger story. Crystal is a 29-year-old woman from a working-class family north of Boston. She's sort of an everywoman character, if you will. She born and raised here, vacationed in New Hampshire, was a big Boston sports fan, and just a generous spirit, somebody who, when she worked at a restaurant out on one of the islands off of Boston, she knew that the boat captains who were bringing people in and out didn't have time to come up, park their boat, come up, and have lunch. So she would bring them lunch down to the dock. She'd bring them burgers and fries and whatever. And that was the kind of spirit that she was. And you know, one of the most poignant details, I think, in the book is that at the finish line, she is there to watch her boyfriend, a boyfriend of one of her friends, run. There's a spot that opens up on the barricade. She lets another woman take that spot because she knows that woman has her friend coming down sooner, right? So she says, no, you go ahead. You go up front. You take it. I'll stay back here. And, you know, that may have put Crystal closer to the bomb, ultimately. And it's sort of sad but also fitting that one of her last acts was one of kindness.
You mentioned boat captains, and, of course, we know that Jokhar Tsarnaev was found in the boat in the backyard of David Henneberry. Did he ever get reimbursed for the boat?
No, he didn't. Here he has a boat that's the, you know, thing that his hobby, he's retired, he loves doing it, he cares for it in meticulous fashion, and all of a sudden now it's part of this crime scene, it's full of bullet holes, they take it away. The happy ending of the story, for him at least, is that because he got so many donations and help from people around the world, he was able to buy another boat. So all is not lost.
What was the story, the real story, of what happened with him that night and finding Jokhar in the boat?
So after this long day where authorities were going house to house searching for him and telling everyone to stay inside, you know, keep the blinds drawn, they go out and have to announce at about 6 o'clock that despite all the searching, they don't know where he is, they've not found him, but, you know, go about your lives, you can go outside, the train is going to start running again. So David Henneberry says, okay, well, that's all the permission I need to go out and check on the boat. So he goes out, check on the boat, he brings a ladder, puts it against its side, climbs up, tries to figure out why a piece of the tarp is askew, and that's when he sees the blood in the boat, and then he follows the blood and sees the body in the boat, and then he quickly runs back inside and calls 911. He was the one who found him, and frankly, I think the authorities are fortunate in a way that this didn't end in a different way, because it was left to David Henneberry to find this guy himself.
But the crazy part of Henneberry's story is that after he goes back in, he knows he's got this guy in the back who's a suspect in a bombing of his city, he lives in Watertown, a suburb of Boston. But after he calls 911, he then goes back outside to the boat, right?
I love that part. So he's on the phone with the dispatcher, and the dispatcher is, you know, saying, okay, we're going to send, you know, police right away. And then the dispatcher says, well, is he still on the boat? And he says, well, I don't know. And he doesn't tell the dispatcher that he's doing this, but he walks back outside to the other side of the boat. And then because he's on a cordless phone, and he tells the dispatcher, yep, you know, he's still on the boat. And the dispatcher says, well, how do you know that? And he said, oh, you know, because I'm out here looking at it. And the dispatcher says, you know, get the heck inside. What are you doing out there?
Yeah.
But I agree. I think that's one of my favorite little details that he sort of takes it upon himself to go back out. I can't imagine doing that.
And while we're on this part of the story, you and Jenna say in the book that this was not really as comprehensive a search through those backyards of Watertown as it should have been.
No, and exactly. So David Henneberry lives only about 18 houses away from where the younger suspect, Jokhar, had left his escape vehicle. So really quite close. And, you know, the authorities had promised that they were going to do an exhaustive search. Not to take anything away from them, they were working hard, and they certainly did search all around Watertown that day. But I do think it's notable that there were some houses and yards that were further away from David Henneberry's house that were searched, in fact. But his house, his boat, was never searched. And I think that's one little indication that it wasn't quite as comprehensive as we were led to believe at the time.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and there are multiple aspects to it, and I appreciate you sharing them with us in the book and on the show here today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Scott Hellman, one of the authors of Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery, and The Epic Hunt for Justice, all about last year's Boston Marathon bombing. His co-author, by the way, Jenna Russell, was one of the reporters at the forefront of the Boston Globe's coverage of that bombing. And they do a terrific job telling all those stories. And you can imagine what the emotions will be like on April 21st when this year's marathon is run. From the start to the finish, everybody will be thinking of what happened last year. And I'm sure along the way, there will be memorials and markers remembering the 3 dead and the 264 wounded. And a reminder about Boston Strong, the slogan that we heard so much throughout 2013 during the bombing and all the way through to, remember, the Red Sox winning the World Series last year. It's an amazing story, one that will have its sequel in just about a week and a half. I'm Paul Harris. This is America Weekend.